Okay, I'd like to begin by saying that I'm very happy to be here in India, and I want to thank the organizers for arranging for everything to go so smoothly here and giving those of us who have not been here before such a great introduction to this marvelous country. You've heard a number of talks in the last few days about tachyon condensation in string field theory, and this will be another one of these talks. The issue that I want to focus on today is the issue of gauge invariance in these kinds of discussions. One of the most successful approaches to making concrete statements about these tachyon condensation issues has been Witten's cubic open string field theory, which is a theory with a very beautiful large gauge invariance. And most of the calculations which have actually been done using this formalism have been done in a gauged fixed fashion, choosing a particular gauge called the Feynman-Siegel gauge. So what I want to talk about today is a set of questions related to this gauge choice, such as, is this really a valid gauge choice? What is the range of validity of the gauge choice? Could we solve the problem without choosing this gauge by choosing either no gauge or other gauges? And that sort of thing. What I'm going to talk about today is work in progress with my student Ian Elwood from MIT. Some of the things I'll talk about at the end are preliminary parts of a hopefully more complete analysis, which will appear shortly. Okay, so let me just repeat some things which you've already heard before. About a little over a year ago, Ashok Sen made this very nice conjecture that a classic problem in string theory, the tachyonic instability of the bosonic open string, might be understood in terms of the decay of a space-filling 25 brain. And he furthermore proposed that open string field theory is a tool with which it might be possible to make some very concrete calculations to verify this picture. So the idea is that there's this tachyon and that string field theory should allow us to describe an effective potential with a stable vacuum. Some concrete predictions made by this conjecture are first that the energy gap between the unstable vacuum and the stable vacuum will be precisely the tension of the 25 brain times the volume of space-time. Sorry, the volume. That the lower dimensional D brain should appear as solitons in this theory. And furthermore, that what we should see at the bottom of the hill should be the closed string vacuum. So at this point, there's actually very good evidence for the first two of these predictions. You've heard some things about that, and you will probably hear more in the course of this talk. There's a less complete understanding of the string vacuum at the bottom, and I think that's really the most important open question at this point about this problem. I'll just say a few words about Witten's cubic string field theory. For every perturbative state in the single string Fock space, there's a space-time field. And a string field is constructed as a formal sum over all Fock space states multiplying space-time fields. The cubic string field theory action is this very simple action with a quadratic part determined by the BRST operator Q, and a cubic part, where the star product is given by gluing two strings together at their midpoint, or connecting the midpoints. This action is a Chern-Simons-like action that has a very large gauge invariance. It's gauge invariant under this transformation here, where lambda is a ghost number zero string field. Phi, by the way, is a ghost number one string field. Q gives a linear part of this gauge transformation, linear in lambda, but independent of phi. There's also a part of the gauge transformation which is linear in phi and linear in lambda. So in most previous work on tachyon condensation using this formalism, people have chosen Feynman-Siegel gauge, in which B naught phi is taken to vanish, which basically kills all the fields which are associated with Fock space states with a C naught acting on the vacuum. Furthermore, in order to make the problem tractable, to reduce to a finite number of degrees of freedom, people have done level truncation, following the ideas of Kostolesky and Samuel of some time ago, years ago, in which one drops all fields above a certain level L and all interactions above a total level I. So the simplest question that one can attempt to approach using this gauge-fixed action is the first of the consequences of Sen's conjecture, the energy gap between the unstable and stable vacua. And this level truncated gauge fixed string field theory gives remarkably nice results for that part of the proposal. If you just include fields up to level 2 and interactions up to level 6, there are 3 fields, and you already get 96% of the correct deep brain tension. If you include fields up to level 4, there are 10 fields, you get 98.6%, as was shown by Sen and Zwieback. And if you go up to level 10-20, there are 252 fields, and you get 99.91% of the correct tension. So this is converging very rapidly, and it gives a fairly convincing picture that this is going to work. Now, let me make a couple of comments which can be interpreted as motivations for studying gauge invariance of this theory. First of all, let me mention a complication which arises when one tries to study this tachyon condensation problem in this way. So when we looked at these level truncated field theories, which are really just theories of finite numbers of variables independent of space-time because we're dropping momentum dependence, we can look at the effective potential for the tachyon. So to do that, we fix a value for the tachyon, and we solve a system of quadratic equations for all the other fields in the string field up to a certain level. And then we plug them back into the action, and we get an effective potential. It turns out that this effective potential has branch points at various points, which correspond to places where the roots of the quadratic equations that we are solving become complex. If we do a level truncated analysis and we increase the level, we found that the positions of those branch points seem to approach finite places in phi, which are, okay, so this here is the unstable vacuum, this is the stable vacuum. There's a branch point to the left over here and a branch point to the right over there, and they seem to approach fixed points. So that seemed kind of interesting. For one thing, an interesting question is what happens if the tachyon rolls off to the left? And the existence of that branch point makes it a little hard to answer that question using this approach. So there have been a number of speculations as to what these branch points might mean and whether they're physical or not. What I'm going to talk about today is an analysis which shows that, in fact, these branch points seem to be gauge artifacts, results of using the Feynman-Siegel gauge. Another motivational comment to study the gauge invariance is the question of the physics around the stable vacuum. As I said earlier, I think this is really one of the central questions at this point in this area is trying to really understand the physics in the stable vacuum. Where do the open strings go? Where do the closed strings come from, if indeed they are there? We heard some very intriguing talks by Ashok Sen and Barton Zwieback in the last 2 days with a certain proposal of how to understand the physics around the stable vacuum. Elwood and I have been looking at the level truncated action around this vacuum, and we have got a pretty reasonable picture of it in Feynman-Siegel gauge at this point, with some evidence that the open strings are removed from the spectrum. But to really understand this completely and to be convinced of what we're seeing, I think it's really important to understand the gauge invariance of the action around this point. Let me emphasize that even if we use level truncation to find the vacuum of the string field, we can then take that vacuum and plug it back into the full action, and we will still have a gauge invariant action around that point. So I think it's an important issue to understand for those reasons. I'll just mention very quickly something you've also heard a little bit about already in the talks of Pierre Krauss and of Goshall. And that is the alternative approach known as the background independent or boundary string field theory. This is an alternative formalism which is particularly well suited to problems which involve only the tachyon field and the gauge field. It gives a very simple and complete picture of the tachyon potential. It rolls away to zero as phi goes out to infinity, as discussed by these authors. A couple of comments about this. First, it seems at this point that probably both the cubic string field theory and background independent or BSFT string field theories are correct descriptions, and that they're probably related by a field redefinition. However, in this potential here, there are no branch points. So that seems like pretty good evidence that the branch points I mentioned in cubic string field theory are artifacts. So it's another motivation to try to understand those. One drawback of this approach, which you've heard some discussion of, is the fact that it seems harder to discuss the physics around the stable vacuum using this formalism. It's sort of off at infinity and things are suppressed. At least at this point, it seems perhaps a little simpler conceptually to understand what the action looks like around the vacuum of the cubic string field theory, which for me is a strong motivation to continue pushing on that formalism. Okay, so let's talk about the gauge symmetry. In order to study this question of tachyon condensation, we can drop all momentum dependence, just consider Lorentz invariant scalar fields. So we want to write a reduced string field, which is a sum over a bunch of variables phi I, which are associated with scalar string states of ghost number one. That's what that exponent one means, that's ghost number. In terms of these phi I's, the action is simply a cubic polynomial with quadratic terms dij and cubic terms tijk. There is a gauge parameter given by a ghost number zero string field, again, a sum of scalar fields mu a multiplying ghost number zero string states. And the gauge invariance of the system is the statement that delta phi I is given by something linear in the mu's and something else linear in the phi's and mu's, and linear in both the phi's and the mu's. So we've gone ahead and used symbolic manipulation programs and things to calculate the full non-gauge fixed action out to level 816. Actually, we now have it out to level 1020, and my computer in Boston is currently computing the gauge transformations for those fields. But we have it up to this order, and we can now start to ask questions using that non-gauge fixed string field action. So first of all, as a check to make sure that we've got the right thing, we can look at the gauge invariance out to order g to the 1, and that is still satisfied in level truncation. So that works out exactly, and it's a check on our calculations. The order g squared invariance is only approximate because we need all the fields in the string field to get that invariance. But we can check it at each level, and we see that it improves as the level truncation goes up. So everything seems nice and consistent there. So let me give a sort of a picture of what this looks like at level 2 as a simple example. At level 2, okay, so there's the level 0 string field, the level 0 field, the tachyon. At level 2, there are three fields. I can call them B, beta, and eta, associated with these three string Fox space states. The field eta is one which is usually set to 0 in Feynman-Siegel gauge, but it enters into the action just as all the other fields do. At level 2, there's a single gauge parameter, which I'll call mu, multiplying this ghost number zero string field. And we can write down all the linear transformations of these four fields. Something to note here is that each of these, in addition to having something dependent on the other fields, each of the level two fields has a piece which depends only on mu and not on the other fields. So the fact that delta eta has a term which goes like minus mu is why we can, in the vicinity of the origin, choose Feynman-Siegel gauge. Now, the level 2 action was actually earlier computed by Restelli and Zwieback, and we can check under this gauge invariance, at least at order level g to the 1, that that's correct. Let me just put this over here for a moment. Very good. OK, so now I want to ask some interesting questions about this non-gauge fixed action. The first question is, when is Feynman-Siegel gauge a good choice of gauge? So near the origin, the gauge transformations are just constant vector fields. These pieces over here, which don't depend on the fields, give a constant vector field. It's easy to show that Feynman-Siegel gauge, which here just means setting eta to 0, is always a good gauge choice. But as we turn on various fields and move away from the origin, it's no longer clear that there will be a non-zero transformation of these Feynman-Siegel gauge fields. And in fact, there's a determinant given by the determinant of a matrix MQA where we have these are the terms that are linear in the mu's, and then these are the terms which are linear in the mu's and the phi's. When this determinant vanishes, that is going to give a point in field space where Feynman-Siegel gauge is going to break down. So in level truncated theory, this is just a finite size matrix, and we can compute the locus of points where this determinant vanishes. So that's what I'd like to now discuss. Let me give you a very simple example just to kind of give a picture of how this works. Imagine we just kept two fields, phi and eta. Then there's a simple field transformation for phi and for eta that looks like this. Feynman-Siegel gauge amounts to setting eta to 0. Clearly, this is a good gauge choice near the origin, but when eta and delta eta both go to 0, which is when phi is equal to this number, there's no longer any transformation of eta, and Feynman-Siegel gauge breaks down. So I can show a picture making this perhaps a little more graphically clear. So Here's a picture of the gauge transformations in the Phi Eta plane. The blue lines are the gauge orbits. And at the origin, of course, the gauge transformation just moves you straight down. But as you move along to negative phi, at this point, the gauge choice breaks down because you then move sort of back out to gauges, to gauge slices you've already selected. This entire red region here would not be accessible in Feynman-Siegel gauge. So this is a picture of where the boundary of Feynman-Siegel gauge will hit. Okay, so we've computed these determinants of MQA on various different subspaces at various levels, and we find the interesting result that that the closest vanishing locus of this determinant to the origin seems to be stable under level truncation. So that is that there's a region of validity of Feynman-Siegel gauge which we can actually get a very clear picture of in the level truncated language. So I'll show you a picture of what this looks like in the vicinity of the origin of field space. So these are four lines representing the level 2, 4, 6, and 8 approximations to the boundary of the region of validity of Feynman-Siegel gauge. It nicely contains the origin, but truncates the region at that point, and it seems to converge fairly nicely. Okay, so we've done this computation up to level 816, and the level 1020 is still sort of in progress. So there's a number of new results we can see here. First, as I said, it looks like the region of validity of Feynman-Siegel gauge is finite, and it seems to be stable. Let me show you a couple more pictures of this. So here, this is a picture of just the one boundary right by the origin. We can blow up to a slightly larger scale and look at, so this is the level 2.6 approximation to the determinant. What I'm plotting here is the sign of the determinant. Black regions are positive sign, white regions are negative sign. So this region here, this sort of parabolic region, is the boundary, or this is the region which contains the origin, which is Feynman-Siegel gauge. I've graphed here just so you get some sense of the scale. This dot here is the unstable vacuum. This is the stable vacuum. And this point here and this point here are the two branch points which you see at the end of the tachyon potential. So that's the level 2 truncation. We can go up to level 4. We get a similar picture, but outside that one central region, we get more structure appearing. Then at level 612, we get even more structure. So the thing to note here is that this central region has a form which is starting to converge fairly well, but all kinds of extra stuff starts appearing outside there. So that the global structure is a little hard to see, but the local structure is perhaps more clear. I'll blow up again to a larger scale, just to show you a little more of the large-scale structure of this. You have, again, this region here and then some other stuff. And as we got to higher level truncations, we see that this region has a similar boundary here. It starts to contract a little on the right. We get all kinds of structure out at large distances, which gets very complicated. So it's pretty clear we don't have any very good information from level truncation about what's going on out here. But we see that this one region here is starting to look like a very nice little ellipsoid or something. Hopefully, if we get a little more information, we can start to see whether this stabilizes out at this side and decouples from this region and things like that. But we get some nice pictures. Okay, so the next point which we can get out of this is that the branch points, which I mentioned a little while ago, in the tachyon effective potential, seem to correspond to the points where the tachyon, where this curve of the solution for all the fields in terms of the tachyon crosses the boundary of region of Feynman-Siegel gauge. So I showed you in a couple of earlier pictures the curve living inside that region, and you could sort of see that the two branch points approach the boundary. Of course, I was plotting this in two dimensions, and the curve is moving around in a very high-dimensional space. So it's hard to see from that kind of plot whether it really hits the boundary or not. What we can do, however, is we can plot the, where's my, wrong box of transparencies. We can plot the determinants as a function of phi as we move along the effective potential. So here's the level 4 determinant being plotted as we move along the potential, we see that here's the open string vacuum, the stable vacuum is down here. At both ends, as we approach the branch points, the determinant starts to suddenly plummet. It's a little hard to do the numerical analysis around here because we're approaching this singular point. But basically, the derivative here becomes negative infinity, and here becomes almost infinite. So it's very clear that we're actually hitting the boundary of this region of field redefinition, the boundary of the region of Feynman-Siegel gauge as we hit these branch points. So I think it's pretty convincing evidence that that's what these branch points are. They're really just gauge artifacts. Make another interesting comment about this. As I commented earlier, we can do a calculation in Feynman-Siegel gauge to get the vacuum. That should still be a valid vacuum in the non-gauge fixed theory. That tells us that we actually have an extra set of equations that we can use, which should be satisfied by that vacuum. And those are the equations of motion of the extra gauge fields, which in level truncation are not automatically satisfied. So this basically gives us an extra set of constraints for the Feynman-Siegel gauge fixed solution. And we can check and make sure these are satisfied. And for instance, the equation of motion for this first field, eta, you can check and it cancels at like 99.7% at level 6. So this set of constraints is something which we can add to the basket of other constraints that people have found. Other things were mentioned by Hata and Shinohara from the BRST invariants, which is another closely related thing one can check. Other constraints by Schnabel and Zwieback. Gives us lots of extra equations, which hopefully might give us some clue as to how to find some analytic solution of this thing. Okay, let me come to a couple of other questions. Another question which we can ask is it possible to find the vacuum or to find information about the vacuum without doing gauge fixing? So we found that the effective potential runs into the boundary of this region of gauge definition. Why not try to do the whole thing without gauge fixing? If gauge fixing maintained, if level truncation maintained gauge invariance, we wouldn't be able to do this. But since level truncation breaks gauge invariance, once we level truncate, we have a system of n degrees of freedom and n quadratic equations, which have a finite set of points on which they're satisfied. So we can try to find solutions for that system of equations. So for instance, at level 2, 6, we can try to solve a system of four quadratic equations for four degrees of freedom. And we find that actually there are two plausible solutions. One of them has an energy of about 88%, and one of them has an energy of about 108% of what we expect. Now, this is not so good. When we did level truncation, we got almost 96%. This solution here, by the way, I should add, was also found by Rastelli and Zwieback when they wrote down that action to that order. It helps a little to look at the effective potential associated with those solutions. Put it over here. What we see is that there are actually several branches of the effective potential which contain plausible-looking vacua. We have a branch up here, we have a branch down here. One of them is above the number we want, one of them is below the number we want. No obvious way to tell which of them is better in any sense. We can continue this at higher level and things just get worse. At level 4 there are at least three solutions. There's one at 92%, one at 96%, one at 107% again. There may be more. This is not necessarily exhaustive. In Feynman-Siegel gauge, we get something which is better than any of those. So it really seems to be problematic to try to do this without fixing gauge. First of all, we get lots of different choices for the branches. And we don't know how to choose which branch we have. And even if we did, it's not clear that we would get answers that are anywhere near as good. You can sort of understand why we get multiple branches here, by the way. If gauge invariance was maintained under level truncation, we would see an infinite number of copies of this branch. It would just be a flat direction in which we could move. Since we haven't maintained gauge invariance, what we're seeing is just a bunch of copies along the would-be flat direction. Okay, so that seems a bit problematic. This, I should add, is one of the parts of this which is still work in progress. So hopefully we'll have a slightly more complete picture of this presently. Another question we can ask is, how about other gauges? So there's a very simple class of gauges we can choose which are closely related to Feynman-Siegel gauge. These are gauges where we choose a slightly different set of fields to make vanish in the vicinity of the origin. For instance, if we recall the form of the gauge transformations at level 2, we see that all three of the level two fields have linear transformations under mu, independent of the fields. That means that at least locally, we can set any of those three fields to vanish, and it'll be a locally valid gauge choice. So we could choose B vanishing, beta vanishing, or eta vanishing. We can test all three of those, and we get answers in the vicinity of 90%. Not quite as good as eta, but not that much worse. At level four, we have lots of fields. We have 15 fields. We have many, many different gauge choices. You can explore lots of possibilities. Let me just show you one example which gives you a sense of what can happen. There's one simple gauge choice where we basically trade one Feynman-Siegel gauge field for one other field. In this case, it's 15 and 12. Doesn't really matter what numbers they are. Just a slightly different gauge choice. If we make that gauge choice and choose Feynman-Siegel gauge for all other fields, we get the following answers. At level 4, we get 99.85% of the vacuum. At level 6, 100.28. Level 8, 100.38. So it starts out looking very promising. It starts out looking better than Feynman-Siegel gauge. Numbers get larger than 1, which is a little annoying. And then they seem to get worse at level 8. Now, you can look at various situations like this, and you see that in general, these numbers tend to return back towards 1. So the problem is that you no longer have a guarantee of monotonicity when you don't choose Feynman-Siegel gauge. But other than that, all these other gauge choices seem to give qualitatively similar answers to what we got in Feynman-Siegel gauge. So the upshot of this is that Feynman-Siegel gauge doesn't seem too much better or worse than any of the others in this wide class of gauge choices, but it does seem to have the advantage that it gives a series of answers which are monotonic. And whether that's something very deep or not is kind of unclear to me. I don't know why that should be. It's an interesting question. One would certainly like to ask the question, are there other better gauges? All the gauges I discussed here are simple linear gauge choices. Perhaps one could choose some nonlinear gauge and do better. Okay, I'm just about out of time, so let me just summarize the main points of what I've said. So one of the main points here is that Feynman-Siegel gauge is definitely not a good global gauge choice. There's a finite size region of validity. If you look at big values of the fields, they're well outside the region in which this is a valid gauge choice. It just so happens that the two vacua which we're interested in, the unstable vacuum and the stable vacuum, neatly fit right near the boundary of this region. They do seem to be inside, but they don't seem to be very far inside. And we can see that because of these branch points in the effective potential, which are fairly close to the two individual vacua. We found that it's a bit hard to compute anything systematically without doing gauge fixing, that there are a variety of other gauge choices we might make, but we don't have any really systematic understanding of those other gauge choices. Feynman-Siegel gauge seems to have a few special properties, like the monotonicity, but otherwise it doesn't seem to be too different from other gauges in this limited, simple class of gauges I mentioned. So let me just mention quickly a couple of further directions and other areas of work in progress right now. One is finding the direct connection to the boundary string field theory, something David Kutusov and I are doing some work on right now. Understanding the gauge invariance directly in the metastable vacuum and how this connects to this mass term which appears for the AMU gauge field in the vacuum is something of some interest. And finally, using gauge invariance to control the spectrum calculation, which Elwood and I are doing at the bottom of the hill, is something we're pushing hard on at this point. So I'll stop there, and thank you for your attention.
Your questions?
Should there be a global gauge?
There's certainly not a linear global gauge. No, I don't see any reason that there should be a global gauge choice.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let us thank the speaker again.